Well, hello. We're ready for chapter 9 of The Door in the Wall. Here we go. The fog held for days. The Welsh could not get beyond the outer wall of the castle, and the English inside could not tell what strength the enemy possessed. They might be encamped on the surrounding hills, or they might be only a small camp company. Several of the guards on the wall had been injured, and sometimes the yeomen could tell that an arrow had struck home in the enemy's camp. Most of the time there was only watchful waiting on both sides. The Welsh had a machine for catapulting stones, most of which thudded harmlessly into the courtyard. Sometimes one struck the inner wall, but most of them fell short, dropping into the moat. Inside, the keep women occupied themselves with spinning, weaving, and embroidery. It helped the time to pass more quickly. The children played with toy soldiers and blocks, with hobby horses and with dolls. Sometimes Robin told them tales or sang songs, but he spent most of the time in the chamber where he slept, working on the Saxon harp. William Wise had set up a workbench for him and had finished the tool of hardened iron. There was a small lathe for turning the keys and a vise all arranged so that Robin could sit on a stool to reach them. The tool for making the holes was sharp, so that part was not difficult. Just as John Goh in the Wind had said, it was harder to turn the keys on the lathe so they would fit exactly. They were either too large and would not go in, or when they had been turned smaller, they were too small and would not hold the strings in tune. But Robin was learning patience. He had found out that the harder it was to do something, the more comfortable he felt after he had done it. Sir Peter had stood all of one night on the bastion, directing and encouraging the men. They had managed to drive off a raiding party that was trying to scale the wall. Now he was in bed with a chill, and Lady Constance waited upon him. The food in the larder dwindled, and there were many people to be fed. Besides the garrison and the household, there were the yeomen from the town and those who had sought refuge when the portcullis was raised. Usually there was a good supply of salt fish kept in barrels, but fish had not been plentiful the past summer, so now the supply was meager. There was mutton, to be sure, but it was all on four legs and scattered over the downs beyond the castle and town. The winter kill had not taken place because they waited for freezing weather. There was flour to last for a short time, but the yearly portion from the peasants' holdings was to have been brought to the castle the following week. Besides, there had been a small crop of grain because of the summer's drought. Then the water began to fail. As Robin came into the hall at supper time, he passed the table where the retainers sat. Dennis leaned to whisper in the ear of Adam, the yeoman. "There is scarce a foot of water in the well," he whispered, "just now as I drew it to fill this ewer, the cook told me." "How came this?" asked Adam. "'Tis known that this is a good well. Tell not her ladyship, and send the word around that the water must be used sparingly, or 'twill not last the week out, even for drinking." He thought a moment, then said, "Somebody must go for help, or we shall be forced to surrender the castle. It might be that Sir Hugh Fitzhugh would come to our aid, for he too is in danger from the Welsh if they break our defense. But whom shall we spare? All are needed at their posts." "Let me go," said Robin. "I can go out the small door at the north whilst it is early morning. No one will suspect me. They think me a poor shepherd. I shall borrow a smock from William the farrier's son, and if I am seen, I shall appear stupid. We shall keep it secret, for if Sir Peter were to find out my plan, he would forbid me to go, not knowing how strong I am." "But thou art only a lad," Adam objected, "and art cumbered with crutches as well. And how wilt thou cross the river? The bridge is well guarded at both ends." "I shall go well, never fear," Robin assured them confidently. I have it all in my head how it shall be done. I shall find John Go in the Wind at his mother's cottage in Tripheath village. John shall set forth from there for Sir Hugh and his men. Now let us plan. First, I want you, Dennis, to bring me the smock and some rags to wrap around my legs. Then see you, find me a hood that is worn and faded. Besides, I shall need long weather thongs to tie the crutches to my back, for I shall swim the river. Fear you not the soldiery? Queried Dennis anxiously. Will you not fall down the steep bank? 'Tis a far distance to the bottom of the ravine, and he stopped suddenly because one of the maids appeared. See to it, said Robin with a quick nod. That evening there was no gathering about the fire. Everyone was restless. The hounds were still uneasy, walking about, cocking their ears at the least sound. Lady Constance took one of her women to examine the stores. Robin was afraid she would discover how low the water was in the well. Instead, she seemed confident that there was sufficient. How fortunate we are that there is plenty of water, she said. Sir Peter says that our well has never failed. Dennis looked at Robin, knowing that he shared the secret. Dennis, knowing Robin's plan, was in a fidget to be through with his duties and find William the farrier's son and borrow his clothes. He would probably be with his father at the forge, repairing pikes and lances and heating oil for pouring onto the enemy in case they should pierce the outer castle wall. Robin put on his warmest under tunic and carefully put away the little harp and all the parts and tools so that they would be safe. He looked at it regretfully, hating to leave it. Then, when all was ready except changing his clothes, he sought out Brother Luke, for he knew that the friar would give him help and encouragement. Dressed in the patched and ragged smock, his legs wound about with bits of rag to hold the ill-fitting hosen, Robin tried to sleep away the early part of the night, but excitement kept him wakeful. Even when he dozed, he was aware of what he was about to do. He counted over all the things he must remember. He must go softly with the crutches. He must remember the leather thongs. As Brother Luke had told him, he mustn't forget oil for the rusty lock of the door in the wall. He must keep Dath quiet. Just before dawn, Brother Luke touched him. Come, my son, he whispered. We shall say the office before it is time to set forth on thy mission. When the prayers were finished, Robin pulled on the faded hood, tucked the leather thong inside it, and followed the friar. Dath rose from sleep to follow after, but Robin touched his head and whispered a command to him to stop. Dath, stay you here, he said, wishing very much that the dog could go with him. They went down a half flight of steps and across the hall of the keep to the winding stair, making their way quietly among the sleeping servants. They went very slowly, for Robin's crutches tapped an alarm when he made haste, and the least misstep would have sent him clattering down. There was still fog when they came into the open, but it had begun to drift, and there was a gray dawn just beginning to break. "Who goes there?" demanded the sentry at the door. But seeing Robin and the friar, he allowed them to pass, thinking they were bent on some holy errand. Robin shuddered. "Art fearful, my son?" asked the friar. "Not truly," answered Robin, "though 'tis weird in the fog." "Aye, 'tis an eerie feeling to be out in the cheerless dawn, not knowing at what moment an enemy may appear out of the fog," agreed Brother Luke. And at that moment a face did appear, but it was only one of the guards, who thought the two were on their way to the chapel. They reached the sally port in the north wall without meeting anyone else. Brother Luke dipped oil into the lock before trying to open the door. Robin listened. "Hark," he whispered, "I hear the Welsh sentry outside. We can count the paces and can tell how far away he is. 1, 2, 3, 4. They counted 40 paces. Now! Slowly the door opened and Robin slipped outside. Benedictite. whispered the friar in blessing, and closed the door. Quickly, Robin moved away from the door and the wall. In a moment, he was at the edge of the deep ravine. He could hear the river far below, but could not see it for the fog. Now began the dangerous descent. Carefully, Robin tested each clod of dirt, of earth, each bit of stone, before trusting his weight to the crutches, praying the while that the fog would hold. Sometimes he slid on his haunches, sometimes seedling trees held him till he was able to find sure footing. If I should start a stone rolling, he thought, the whole Welsh army will be upon my neck. It seemed hours to Robin that he was sliding, groping, laboring down the treacherous cliff, but it was only a few moments, for the light of morning had scarcely changed when he reached the bottom and found himself at the edge of the river. He stopped only long enough to fasten the crutches onto his back with the leather thongs and to wind his hood into a kind of hat that perched on top of his head. Then he plunged into the icy water, not allowing himself to consider whether he had the courage to do it. When first the water closed over him, Robin thought he could not bear it. The crutches were awkward, his chest felt tightly squeezed, and as if sharp knives pierced him. He seemed unable to breathe, and his head felt ready to burst, but he struck out fiercely, and after a few strokes, began to breathe more easily. Warmth crept through his body, and a feeling of power, as if nothing could be too difficult for him. He swam strongly across the swift current toward the path he had seen from the top of the tower. What if the enemy should be camped on the other side? Suppose they wouldn't believe he was the poor shepherd he pretended to be. Suppose he found it impossible to get up the bank on the other side. Anyone could not do it, he said to himself stubbornly, and thrashed his arms more fiercely. At last, he felt the stones of shallower water under his feet. The bank appeared mistily green, and he was able to hold himself steady with one hand while he untied the crutches and set them under his armpits. The bank was not very steep after all, and in a moment he was at the top, ready to go on. His teeth chattered in the rising wind. His feet felt as if they had been frozen. His hands were so numb with cold he could hardly hold the crutches to steady them as he walked. He paused long enough to let down the hood into its proper shape. The warm wool felt good, although it was wet along the edges. Then he looked about for signs of the path. It had shown so clearly from the top of the tower. He moved along the bank a few paces, where generations of peasants had worn a highway, and soon came to the path. The fog was lifting somewhat with the wind, and Robin, looking back once, caught sight of the castle he had left behind. He even caught a glimpse of the sentry along the narrow ridge just where he had so lately escaped by the door in the wall. After passing through a patch of brush and willows, Robin came out into a field. He still could not see very far ahead, but the path was straight before him, so he began to swing along as fast as he could, his crutches making great sweeping circles, his feet covering the ground in tremendous strides. There seemed to be no one about, so he made haste without regard to noise, and gradually the numbness in his hands and feet began to ease. Across the field he went swinging step, swing step, swing step. The fog wavered and lifted, swirled about in sudden drafts, floated across the path in thin layers, showed a patch of blue sky for an instant and glimpses of trees ahead. Suddenly a voice rang out. "Who goes there?" Robin stopped. "'Tis but I, Robin," he answered in a meek voice, and the chill that ran down his spine was not all from the dampness of his clothing. "Robin who?" the voice went on. "Robin Crookshank, some call me," answered Robin. The fog parted, showing the fierce and scowling head of a man. The guard drew near where he could see the boy. "Ah," he said, "Art thou but a shepherd boy, then?" he asked, seeing Robin's poor clothes. "And hast fallen into the river? Come then, lad, and warm thyself by the fire. Be not frighted, we'll not hurt thee." He took Robin's arm and tried to draw him toward the camp, which now Robin could see just as at the side of the field, for now the fog was fast disappearing. But Robin held back and shook his head, trying to think what he must say and how he must speak. "Nay," he began, trying to appear stupid, "'tis not far to the cottage." He edged away, bobbing his thanks, and went on as fast as he dared up the other side of the field and through the hedgerow. He did not stop until he was well beyond earshot of the men in the camp, then stood only for a moment to draw long, steadying breaths. He chuckled at the way he had fooled the Welshman. From that point on, the path led through a wood and downward toward the valley of a stream which joined the one surrounding the castle. There were no cottages near at hand, but across the stream and beyond a low-lying field and a rising slope, Robin could see the wood that extended to the edge of the village where the church tower stood. The sky now was filled with fast-flying clouds, and the fog was gone. The stream was shallow enough for Robin to go across on foot, and the little wetting he got was nothing after swimming the river. The wood behind him hid Robin from the camp in the field, for which he was thankful because the rising ground slowed his going, and he felt as if he were a fair target for arrows. It seemed as if he would never come to the top of the field and the hedgerow separating it from the forest beyond. When he reached the shelter of the great trees, Robin sank down into a bed of bracken to rest. He was very tired. When breathing was easier and the pain of effort but a dull ache, Robin rose to go on. How much farther had he to go? Would John be there when he arrived? Would he be able to get help in time? Even through the forest, the path was well marked because it was one that had been used for centuries. The peasants went over it to and from the villages to gather wood or to pasture the sheep. In about an hour, the forest began to thin, and Robin could see the blue smoke coming from the cottar's chimney pots. Which cottage belonged to John's mother? Robin remembered that John had said it was on the heath and near the church. He could see such a cottage from where he stood, so he made his way toward it hopefully. It was so exciting to be within sight of help that Robin forgot that he was tired and hungry. He forgot that he was still cold from his dousing in the river and the fright he'd had. He began to cut across the heath toward the cottage, but had not gone far when John himself came out of the door. Robin stopped. "John," he called at the top of his voice. "John! Oh, John, go in the wind!" John heard him and looked his way, then came running. "Master Robin," he exclaimed, "what's amiss? What's amiss? How came thou here?" Without waiting for an answer, he grasped Robin's clutches and swept him up in his arms because he could see that Robin had come as far as he was able. It had been Robin's plan to issue orders, as his father might have done, to have been lordly and commanding, but it was such a relief to be cared for and to have the weight of his body taken from his aching armpits that he allowed John to carry him and said not a word until he was laid upon the straw pallet. An old woman stood by the fire stirring something in a pot. She looked at Robin but didn't speak. A cat meowed and coaxed her, rubbing against her skirts. "The castle is in danger," said Robin at once. "The Welsh have taken the town and are at the gates of the outer bailey. The food is giving out, the water low in the well. You must get help. You must get it soon." "But how came thou here?" said John, amazed. "How didst escape the sentry?" John was already putting on his hood and fastened his leather jerkin. He went on without waiting. "Knowest what force the Welsh have?" "No," said Robin. "The fog has kept us from seeing, but whenever we tried to make a sally into the town, we were forced back." I shall be gone straightway. Stay thou here for safety and to rest. John Go in the Wind was well named, for go he did, closing the door behind him almost before he had finished speaking. Robin sighed. It was good to be able to rest. Come now, said the woman, as she took off Robin's clothes to dry them. Thou'lt be famished with hunger. I'll bake thee a bannock. As tired as he was, Robin grinned. She went to the cupboard and took out a flat cake, which she put on a hot stone to bake. Robin slept after the woman fed him, and didn't wake until the sun was low in the west. The sound of the door opening was what really woke him. It was John. Robin was up on his elbow in a second. Did you not go then? He asked in bewilderment. Then he realized he had slept and that it was late in the day. Did you find help then? And here's a picture of the woman getting food. Yes, already they are well on their way from my lord Hugh Fitzhugh's castle, said John. A large force of foot soldiers and a company of lancers go by the drover's road, one company by the way through wood and field, and another going around to attack from the other side of the town by way of Lethem Bridge. It hath been agreed that we shall give the signal from the bell tower of the church. There are no better bowmen in England. The siege will be lifted. Thou'lt see. I want to see it, declared Robin. I want to see it all. See it thou shalt, promised John. Now, mither, serve forth yon porridge, for I have not broken my fast this day. The mother bustled about, putting the porridge into a bowl for all to dip into, and drawing a bench up to the table. John laid out the little harp, put bread into his pouch, and stuck a knife in his belt. I am no warrior, he said to Robin. I am but a messenger and a minstrel. But who knows, I might find myself close to the enemy, closer than I would like, he added with a shrug. The meal was soon over, and they made ready to start. Think you I can go so far again this day? Asked Robin anxiously. Thou hast no need to think of that, John assured him. I can carry thee right well, as the good friar did. The harp and the crutches we shall strap on so they will not cumber us. He fastened the crutches to his side and the harp around Robin's neck, so it hung down his back. Soon thou'lt be carrying thine own harp, God willing. Fare thee well, old mother, said John, embracing her. Up now, young master, he said to Robin, and with that they left the cottage and went on their way. How shall we go? Asked Robin, as John strode down the path on the way out of the village. Shall we go by the way I came here, or by the way of Lethem Bridge? Neither, answered John Go in the Wind. I know still another way. I know a path leading through the forest to the southeast. It goeth past the priory, where we shall ford the river. We can come at the town easily from there. Then we can wait for nightfall, and indeed it will be nightfall ere we arrive, but there we will be a moon. We shall creep along the river under cover of the reeds and willows, and enter the town through the shoemaker's house, which is on the wall. He is known to me, and we have a signal between us. He knoweth the sound of my harp, and the certain tune I play will tell him we have need of him. From there it is quite simple to get into the graveyard of the church, thence into the church itself and into the tower. There we shall see all and hear all, if we are not deafened by the bells. What an adventure to tell my father, cried Robin. Although he carried Robin, John trotted along at a good speed, for he knew every curve in the path. It was only a short way to the ford of the river, near the priory, and from there across fields covered with grazing sheep to the forest. They rested. When they reached the top of the hill beyond, John pointed out the drover's road far below. There, glints of light on lance and pennant, helmet, and moving figures showed Robin the fast-moving company of soldiers. Because it was nearly dusk and supper time, blue smoke rose from every chimney pot in the village they had left, and in the low places mist began to rise. "We must make haste," said John, lifting Robin again to his back, "or we shall be too late." When they had to cross open country again, John crept to the hedgerows so they would not be seen. And as they came nearer to Lindsay, he kept well away from every barn and outbuilding. "For aught we know, the Welsh may be encamped out here on this side of the castle as well as on the other," he explained. "They might question even a minstrel such as I. 'Tis safer for our skins to go softly." By the time they reached the place where the drover's road led, John halted before crossing the road to observe the sentry. They waited for the sound of his footsteps to die away around the town. The moon was high, and by keeping well in the shadow of a tree, they were able to cross the road without being seen. "Ah," said John with a sigh of relief, "so far we have come safely. Soon Sir Hugh's men will encircle the town. By then we shall be in the church tower to give the signal for attack." "We have not seen the enemy on this side of the town," whispered Robin hopefully. "No," agreed John, "because they have taken the town and will be inside the walls. There is more need of outposts to the south and west, where the two bridges are, and where the roads leading from them are well traveled. The Welsh will reason that there is little likelihood of danger from this road, because it is well known that Sir Peter and his cousin Sir Hugh are not on friendly terms. Sir Peter is for the king and for England. Sir Hugh is not. But they are of one family, and were once like brothers. I had little difficulty in persuading him, Sir Hugh." "Perhaps they will be friends from now on," said Robin. "Perhaps Sir Hugh will be one for the king." "It may be," John nodded. "Most of the lords in this part of the country are for keeping their lands to themselves, but times are changing, and we have a good king." "Hark," whispered Robin again. "All is still. The sentry is at the far end of his walk. Shall we go then?" "Aye, 'tis time," said John. "Hast the little harp safe?" "'Tis safe," said Robin, grasping John about the neck and getting himself settled on his back. They crept forward again, shielded by the darkness, and made their way along a narrow path that followed the wall until the rising ground told John they were near to the shoemaker's cottage. There again they halted to make sure no sentry was about. John, letting Robin slip to the ground, fitted the crutches under his arms and took the harp from about his neck. The tune he played was mournful and slow, but it must have reached the ears of the shoemaker. John was just beginning to play it for the third time when there was an answer to it in the form of a bagpipe jig. Robin could see John bobbing his head up and down happily because his playing had brought forth the right response. There followed another period of waiting while the sentry passed again on the wall. They scarcely breathed until he had turned again and was going the other way. By counting his steps, they knew when he was far enough away for them to act. Then, without warning, a sort of chair was let down from a high window in the wall. John fastened Robin into it and gave the rope a jerk. Robin was hauled aloft so quickly that he had no time to think what he should do or what he should say. He found himself being lifted inside the upper room of a small house and the window drawn to. He faced a little man who cautioned him to silence while again they waited for the sentry to come and to go. There was no light in the room except the moonlight that came in through the window. "This is really exciting," thought Robin. He wished that John had been able to come into the house with him. He heard the tramp, tramp of the sentry and the thudding of the pike staff as it struck the stone when the sentry turned at the wall of the house. The sound lessened, and once more the rope was lowered. This time it was for John. Robin could see the iron wheel under the window, which turned like a windlass to let out the rope. In a moment, John stood in the room with him. The rope and iron wheel was stored in an innocent-looking chest. The shoemaker quickly lifted the wheel out of the strong wooden block, which held it covered with a flat board and cloth. The shoemaker motioned for Robin and John to follow him down the steep stair leading to the house below. And that is the end of chapter 9. Join us again for chapter 10.